The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974, and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. Thank you, Carter Glass. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we return to the April 2021 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month has been art in great wide open spaces. We read some of that last time. Now we're going to move up a bit into the air. This article that we're going to start with today is entitled Freedom at 20,000 Feet. The young man's love of open spaces inspired him to start his own airline, blaze a trail into history, and pass his knowledge on to a new generation of pilots. There's a view out of a small plane's window here, coming into a small airport runway. And on the right-hand page, a smiling man looking upward, perhaps waiting for that plane or a different one. It says, pilot Warren Wheeler shares his love of flying with future pilots like Ellis Woodward, Woodyard, in the opposite picture that I just mentioned before, through his Aerolina Young Aviators, AYA, nonprofit program. The old man was not formally educated, but 10-year-old Warren Wheeler hung on to his every word during those summer nights in the bright glare of sunshine on rippling water. The old man was a waterman, and young Wheeler was his student. The child had learned plenty from his own highly educated father, the president of the Mechanics and Farmers Bank of Durham, who would later help draft the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Wheeler also learned a lot from his mother, a Howard University and Hampton Institute graduate who long served as the head librarian at what was then known as the Durham Colored Library. But this old fisherman, Charlie Harris, taught Wheeler things that his parents couldn't. Harris regularly visited and invited the kid on excursions into the open water, where Wheeler learned what freedom felt like. But freedom can be fleeting. The Coast Guard eventually told the old waterman that he had to be certified before he could carry people out in a boat. And being certified meant passing a test. Well, he couldn't do that because he couldn't even read or write, says Wheeler, who, many years later, would found the nation's first black-owned air carrier, Wheeler Airlines. But there was nobody I'd rather be out in the water with than that man, Wheeler continues, because he knew more about the water than anybody. He was educated in terms of operating a boat. One day, Harris let Wheeler take the steering wheel. When Wheeler turned too sharply, cables got wrapped around the wheel, and the boat went into a spin. The fisherman remained calm. He quietly, calmly came up, took my hands off the steering wheel, and straightened everything out, Wheeler says. And he looked at me and said, "Son, don't mess with what you don't understand." Wheeler, now 77, laughs as he recalls the valuable lesson. If that's not an educated man, we don't understand the meaning of the word education. Wheeler was 3 years old the first time his family packed up their car and drove from their home in Durham to the peaceful Robert R. Moton House in Gloucester, Virginia. It was the earliest of many annual trips that the family took to the stately brick mansion that butts up against the blue-gray waters of the York River. Wheeler grew up longing for those summer escapes when he came into contact not just with modest fishermen like Harris, but also with prominent black leaders who were ushering in a new era of freedom in the 1950s. Inside the Moton House, legal minds hashed out strategies for cases that were part of the Brown versus Board of Education ruling, which rendered school segregation illegal in 1954. And it said that Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. put the finishing touches on his 1963 I Have a Dream speech while relaxing on a stone bench under a tree outside. The Moton House was a think tank and a vacation spot for wealthy and influential African-American movers and shakers to take their families during a time when black people of all social and economic strata were barred from white resorts and conference centers. For young Wheeler, though, freedom wasn't just the new advances in civil rights that he was hearing about. It also meant looking out over the sprawling York River or up into the vastness of a cloudless southern sky. When he returned home to Durham, Wheeler would think back on the conversations that he'd heard around the Moton House table, like the time the president of Tuskegee Institute described what it felt like to fly an airplane upside down. I would be like, what is he talking about? Wheeler says incredulously, how do you get an airplane to fly upside down? Black people didn't even fly in little airplanes back then. The image stuck with Wheeler. And when his older sister Julia, who was taking flying lessons, was invited by an aircraft salesman for a short trip in a little four-seat Cessna 172, her younger brother tagged along. Before then, Wheeler had dreamed of sailing boats in the ocean. Now he dreamed of piloting airplanes in the wild blue yonder. After that flight, he says, I was hooked on airplanes. Wheeler was just 16 when he earned his private pilot's license. 2 years later, he enrolled in the Agricultural and Technical College of North Carolina, now NCAT State University. But he soon grew bored with his classes and dropped out to study aviation at the American Flyers School in Ardmore, Oklahoma. At 19, after graduating from the AFS program and earning his commercial pilot's license, Wheeler set up shop in Chapel Hill, where he began teaching white college students from the University of North Carolina how to fly. In the early 1960s, getting work for a pilot for a major airline was next to impossible for a young black man. Wheeler applied for jobs, but no one was calling back. Meanwhile, he earned his flying hours by accompanying a pilot who flew charters and by continuing to teach flying lessons. He applied for a job at Piedmont Airlines, but didn't hear back from the company after the interview. Luckily, his father was friends with Governor Terry Sanford, who had flown on some charter trips that Wheeler co-piloted. Sanford knew that Piedmont's airline's president, Tom Davis, and he made a call on Wheeler's behalf. From what I was able to put together, Tom Davis called down to the people who did the interview with me, and he asked about me, Wheeler says. The interviewer said, yes, it seems like he might be qualified. And Davis said, seems like he might be? Well, if he's qualified, hire him. In 1966, Wheeler became Piedmont's first black pilot, and at 22, one of its youngest. He continued with his flight school in Chapel Hill, and in 1969, while still flying for Piedmont, he launched Wheeler Flying Service, a cargo and courier operation, and eventually its commuter and charter wing, Wheeler Airlines. His boss was aware of the side job. Tom Davis knew about it, Wheeler says. I didn't say he endorsed it, but he didn't stop me. As Wheeler's little airline grew, he was burning the candle at both ends, piloting for Piedmont, heading his own company, and encouraging his employees to all chip in on menial duties like loading and unloading luggage, answering passenger questions, and repairing the aircraft. By 1976, the companies that Wheeler had started with just two Piper six-passenger planes and one employee himself had a fleet of 11 planes and 27 employees. He'd expanded his reach across the state from Asheville to Greenville, and his revenues averaged more than $20,000 a month. Most of his passengers were white businessmen, many of whom worked for the Durham-based Burroughs Wellcome Pharmaceutical Company and would travel back and forth between Durham and the company's factory in Greenville. The rest of his business consisted of cargo and courier contracts with companies ranging from banks to the U.S. Postal Service. Wheeler Airlines remained the only minority-owned airline in the nation until the early 80s, and the company did not elude the specter of racism. When more and more small airlines popped up to compete with Wheeler in the computer business, one of them, Sunbird Airlines out of Lincoln County, didn't hesitate to use race against Wheeler. Before the 1990s, there was no online booking, so computers still relied on travel agencies to schedule their flights. So what the guy that owns Sunbird would do is he would go to the travel agencies, and we'd be flying some of the same routes between Charlotte and Raleigh-Durham, places like that. And the travel agent would say, well, we put some people on Wheeler Airlines last weekend. And he would say, you do realize that Wheeler Airlines is owned by a black person, don't you? And that's all it would take. Next time, those people would be on Sunbird. Wheeler's run extended through the 1980s. But a bad business decision and the loss of a key part of his courier service, hauling canceled paper checks from banks to processing centers, finally did him in by the early 90s. Hauling checks, Wheeler says, was the backbone of our business, and that business doesn't exist anymore. Wheeler also was talking about buying a 35-seat turboprop airplane that he didn't really need. It was a mistake, and it took us down, he says. And we didn't have funding to correct it, so that was the end of it. Shutting down the airline was a hard decision for Wheeler, but it turned out to be fortuitous. I don't know what my life would have been like if it didn't happen, because it got me out of the business, he says. I could breathe. Now I can help kids get into it, and that's much more of a contribution. Part of Wheeler's mission all along was to train and employ more black pilots. By 1978, 7 of his 14 pilots were black, and 2 co-pilots were women, one of whom was a black woman. Breaking color and gender barriers and encouraging other aspiring pilots of color is Warren's platform for history, says Anita Neville, who works for Wheeler's current nonprofit, Aerolina Young Aviators of Durham. Aerolina is an aviation STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math program that's available to all teens, but its focus is on the underserved black and Hispanic students. He's retired now from any commercial work, Neville says, but his goal, and it's our model at Aerolina, is to pass it on. During the height of his career as president of Wheeler Airlines, Wheeler kept a 22-foot sailboat in Norfolk, where he'd escaped to on free days to decompress and reflect on his childhood experiences boating and fishing with his mentor, Charlie Harris. In more recent years, Wheeler has kept a 32-foot sailboat docked in the Caribbean, where he's continued to seek the freedom that he felt while gliding across the sun-speckled waters of the Chesapeake Bay. For a while, Wheeler ran an island-hopping airline in the British Virgin Islands, catering or carting tourists to Tortola, Virgin Gorda, and Anegra from St. Thomas and San Juan, but staffing problems brought the business to a standstill. Wheeler misses it, but what he misses most of all is his boat. I still love boats, he says. I like airplanes, too, but I can keep and operate a boat for a lot cheaper than I can an airplane. And in some ways, there's more freedom involved. There's nothing like sitting on an island. Up here in North Carolina, you haven't seen the sky like you see the sky down there. There are no streetlights, and when you're sitting on a boat at 11 o'clock at night, all you can see are stars. His voice softens to a near whisper. There's nothing to stop or obstruct your view. It's like looking through a telescope, but you're on a boat. It's all the same to Wheeler. Whether he's sailing across the water or soaring 20,000 feet in the air, the experience, being alone, surrounded by nothing but deep, deep blue, is pure, and he's free. And that was written by Mark. You are listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. Questions, comments, 919-832-5138. And now, Season of Hope. Pastel dyed eggs dotting the landscape are a sure sign that winter is winding down. But as every gardener knows, patience is key. Spring doesn't necessarily begin when the Easter sermon ends. Written by Susan Stafford Kelly. Never get into an argument with a North Carolinian about which season is the best season. When you live in a state with as many mountains, beaches, golf courses, places to eat, and things to do as our state, best season is a losing game. But the most hopeful season surely is spring, and whatever the science behind the vernal equinox, Easter Sunday can't help but herald the beginning of spring. Thing is, Easter tends to, well, hop around all over April and even March. Ideally, the day falls late enough of the season that you don't need to wear gloves to the sunrise service, and earlier enough that the dogwoods are at their peak perfection. Even better is if it's late enough that after the ham is served, you're able to plant the salvia and geraniums that have been rowed up for weeks at the garden center, lush and luscious, without fear of frost. Which brings me to the area of my attic reserved for holiday decor and paraphernalia. The eggs, or rather the section dedicated to Easter, is pitifully small. My children's Easter baskets are in my children's attics. I don't do an Easter wreath or an Easter tree, and those eggs that dangle from trees and yards, how do they even do that? One reason for the scarcity of decorations, I think, might be that I'm still suffering from the childhood trauma of never having a real Easter dress to talk about on the elementary school playground, pink and petticoated or yellow and frilly. My Easter dress was usually a sailor-collared get-up, navy, nautical, practical, but it did get a hat. Very satisfying indeed, since we'd been singing Irving Berlin's Easter Parade in school assemblies for weeks by that point. It was a straw boater with an elastic strap that itched my chin, so I'd pull it up under my nose. Meanwhile, I'd reach around back for a pair of dangling, gross-grain ribbons and chew on them until they were wet and raveled and ruined and the sermon was over. For a child, surely the best part of Easter is egg dyeing, a process in which, once your mother sets out the teacups reeking of vinegar and a carton of hard-boiled eggs, you have full control. There's the wonder of watching the dye tablets dissolve, pink, purple, orange, yellow, green, blue, blossoming into glossy, jello-looking sheens. You bend the wire dipper just so, lower each egg into a dye bath, and wait vigilantly, turning them frequently. Otherwise, one side will be lighter and one side darker. Perfection spoiled. All the while, you're scissoring out transfer images across a lily, a naked egg with a wax crayon thoughtfully supplied by PAAS. And should you even bother with the cartoon collar that shrinks round the egg when it's submerged? Sometimes they wrinkle unattractively. Easter eggs are a morning's anxious labor for sure. Easter candy never quite lived up to Halloween or Christmas candy either. Pink and white Good and Plenties are still just licorice. Necco wafers and Jordan almonds fill the pastel requirement, but are still just chalk and nuts. Before the gourmet varieties were invented, jelly beans were just hard candy suckers from the doctor's office, converted into eggish shapes. Ignored and avoided, they sank to the bottom of an Easter basket, turned into rock-hard pellets, and rattled around like maracas. And you can keep your peeps. No, for the adult me, Easter is less about the decorations and the symbols than it is a nighttime service at my church called the Great Easter Vigil. A small fire burns in a brazier at the church entrance, the only light before you enter a black, unlit nave, dark and scary and soundless as a tomb. One by one, each worshiper's small, collared candle is lit, just enough of a flame to read by. The service progresses with Scripture and the sorrowful retelling of Christ's trial, crucifixion, and burial. Candles are extinguished, and again the interior is pitch black, silent, and still. Suddenly, dramatically, the organ comes alive with the lilting trills and jubilant crescendos of Wider's Toccato and from Symphony No. 5. The altar bursts into view beneath bright lights, revealing scores of white flowers, lilies and roses and tulips, dogwood and mock orange and spirea, banked at the base, tumbling from and trailing over the marble, clustered at the cross. The bright white sight is breathtakingly beautiful, bountiful. In the congregation, we take out the bells we brought from home, from humble clanging cowbells to tinkling silver chimes, and ring them for all we're worth to join the joy. We've moved from dying to rising, from pervasive gloom to magnificent glory, and then in celebration we get to go home and drink champagne. Whether yours is secular or spiritual, Easter marks ends and beginnings. Biblically, Easter marks the end of Lent's melancholy introspection and the beginning of new life in resurrection. Seasonally, it marks the end of winter's chill and the beginning of new life in the promise of spring. Because even if you're wearing gloves and a scarf to your sunrise service, and very often we are, that sliver of pink dawn on the horizon guarantees that green and growth and warmth are on the way. Just hold your horses with those begonias and impatience. Mid-April, and the beginning of your garden's glory is near. Actually, we have a little more time than I expected here, so I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do, but it's interesting that they have a two-page advertisement here, which I think is worth going over. It's entitled Small Surprises in Our Main Street Communities, the towns and villages of Alamance County. So there are four of them. There's some pictures and a little description. The first is Burlington. Stroll to the beat of the Amtrak train whistling into Company Chop Station. Soak in the architecture, sculptures, murals, unique galleries, and curated art walks that fill downtown's historic streets. Explore our eclectic shops and burgeoning arts and entertainment district, anchored by the historic depot and the Paramount Theater. Gather with friends for farm to table, al fresco dining with live music playing, craft beer flowing, and happy kids giggling as they enjoy scratch-made ice cream. Feel the energy as our burgeoning downtown neighborhood, where 70 new residential lofts, 5 new bars and restaurants and a food hall concept join iconic diners, upstart breweries, and vibrant annual festivals. Experience downtown Burlington. How about Elon? Downtown Elon, being the commercial center of the town of Elon and home to Elon University, became a nationally accredited Main Street community in 2019 and a part of the North Carolina Main Street Communities in 2016. Downtown Elon welcomes you to experience locally owned restaurants who create unique flavor combinations that will make your mouth water, and shops that provide up-to-date fashions, gifts, and home decor, all within walking distance of one of the nation's most beautiful campuses. Our annual event includes live music, car shows, holiday activities like the annual Santa Fun Run, and Taste of Elon, at a downtown farmer's market. Downtown Elon has something enjoyable for everyone in the family. We have big dreams and goals for the future and would love to have you be a part of the future. We look forward to seeing you in downtown Elon. Next in Alamance County, we have Mebane, which is an interesting word because I know somebody whose name is spelled that way and she pronounces it Mebane. It's time you discovered downtown Mebane. Ranked as one of North Carolina's top downtown areas to visit, Mebane combines small-town charm with big-city culture. Start your day by exploring our one-of-a-kind boutiques, antique shops, and hip artisanal galleries. Chances are you'll find your favorite new artist or score some handmade artwork with a rock and roll flavor. Take a break and relax with a soothing glass of herbal tea, or savor the mouth-watering specialty lattes at one of our local coffees and tea shops. Gastronomes will enjoy trying our local culinary treasures that feature farm-fresh ingredients and unique twists on traditional Southern fare. Wander over to the new Mebane Community Park, where you'll find a sculpture immortalizing legendary musicians and Mebane natives Joe and Odell Thompson. Cap off your adventure with a chocolate-covered cherry martini or a cold IPA brewed right here in Alamance County. Are you ready for a new experience? Downtown Mebane is ready for you. And finally, we have Graham. Graham attracts locals of all ages and invites visitors to come spend a day shopping, dining, and being entertained in a way you can only experience around our court square. Visitors stroll around a downtown established in 1851, where historic preservation is present among the familiar and new establishments. There's a mix of the nostalgic burger joints and casual dining. If craft beer satisfies your taste buds, downtown is sure to please. Patrons of the arts are greeted on Main Street at the historic Captain James and Emma Holt White House, home to Alamance Arts. All ages revel in the annual downtown activities presented by Graham's Recreation and Parks Department, Graham area businesses, and community partners. You are invited to come and visit our spaces that give Graham unique character. You have an open invitation to experience our city that circles a square. Plan to spend a day and feel the love created here and established for over 150 years. Love, Graham. There's a thing on the back page called Back in the Day, North Carolina's Hidden History. There's a picture of a bear cub here. It says, folks, look at this cutie little bear cub. There he is in Asheville at the Biltmore Estate. Oh, that's him at the old well in Chapel Hill. Say, is that a lighthouse behind him? Yep. Wouldn't you like to see more of this bear? Wouldn't you like to know his story? If then, you've already figured out that the bear cub advertising works. The little cub in these pictures was 10 weeks old when legendary photographer and Grandfather Mountain proprietor Hugh Morton took him on the road. In April and May of 1972, the cub appeared in 28 programs on 16 television stations and was photographed being adorable in front of the landmarks across the state. It was all part of a bond campaign to raise money to create the North Carolina Zoo. The strategy worked. A contest to name the bear followed a few months later, promising mountain honey to the winner. Hobo was selected, among other entries, which included Heffalump, Butchie Poo, and General Grant. After his big tour, Hobo went to live with other bears at Grandfather. He was a cute bear, but a bear nonetheless, and he sometimes got into tussles with his handlers. He lived for 17 years until 1989, and was the first bear to be buried next to the picnic area. But he's still mostly remembered for being a cub. If I win the honey, a girl from Mooresville wrote in her entry, please keep it and give it to the little bear for a treat. Well, that is about all the time we have today for Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time for one more reading from the April issue. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions, call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to our North Carolina Reading Service.